Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. I'm Cynthia Pooler. My guest today is Scott Ritter, and Scott is here to talk about the G7 summit. So, overall, Scott, before we get started talking about the summit, give an overview of your, you know, what you've done and why it's important for what you've done. I remember you going back to the early 2000s.
Well, no, I actually, especially if we're going to be talking about, you know, the G7 summit, the NATO summit, and then the Biden-Putin summit in Geneva, it's important to realize that, you know, I've been a Russia area specialist, actually started as a Soviet area specialist since the 1980s. And in 1988, I was one of the first inspectors. In fact, I was the first inspector to enter the Soviet Union to implement the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which was the groundbreaking treaty that Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev signed in December 1987. It got rid of, two categories of extremely destabilizing nuclear weapons in Europe, and is seen as sort of the bedrock, or it was at least until Donald Trump withdrew from it a couple years ago, was the bedrock of modern arms control. So I spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union working with Soviets, and then I spent a lot of time in the 90s working with Russians in the field of disarmament, in particular in Iraq. I've been a disarmament specialist, a non-proliferation specialist, and I was involved in two of the, I think the most important and groundbreaking arms control activities in modern times, that being, of course, the INF Treaty implementation in the Soviet Union, and then the disarming of Iraq in the 1990s. I was also involved in the Gulf War back in 1991. I was on General Norman Schwarzkopf's staff and played a rather important role in developing strategies to counter Iraqi Scud attacks against Israel and the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. So I'm well grounded in arms control. I think some people might know me from the stance I took starting in 2000, or even before that, in 1999, opposing American policy in the Middle East, in particular the policy in Iraq, which seemed to be geared towards regime change, getting rid of Saddam Hussein, than actually disarming Iraq of its weapons of mass destruction. But before I became an anti-war activist, I had over a decade's worth of experience, hands-on experience, in disarmament and in actual combat operations.
So what was your view of the summit that just happened this week?
Well, I think it was a very critical summit, very important summit. In fact, I think it will go down in history as one of the landmark diplomatic engagements, so far this century. And the reason why I say that is that a lot of people said that today U.S.-Russian relations are the worst since the Cold War. I would say no, that's wrong. They are even worse than the Cold War, because during the Cold War, we had diplomatic engagement, robust diplomatic engagement. The Soviet Union and the United States were butting heads around the world, and we were sitting on top of the world's two largest nuclear arsenals, a situation that exists to this date. But because of diplomatic interaction, because of diplomatic engagement, we never went to war. And that's a very important thing to point out. We never went to war with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Every issue was resolved peacefully through diplomacy. This doesn't mean that we were friends. In fact, during the entire Cold War, we never used the word friend. Ronald Reagan spoke of the Soviet Union as the evil empire. It wasn't until the very end of his presidency in 1989, when he went to the Soviet Union, to Moscow, and I believe actually 1988, and he And he spoke to Soviet students, and he said, I used to think of you as the evil empire, but now I think of you as friends. It wasn't until the very end that we could even, think about being friends with the Soviets / Russians, but we didn't go to war. But in 2014, Barack Obama started the process of, reversing diplomacy with Russia when the Russians annexed the Crimea after the Maidan coup in Ukraine. We began to stop talking with the Russians about critical issues. I mean, George W. Bush, did some of that in 2008 after the Russian invasion of Georgia. But from that point on, we had a gradual dissolving of diplomatic engagement. During the 4 years of Donald Trump, we didn't even staff critical mid- to low-level positions in the State Department and the Department of Defense that dealt with, interactions with their Russian counterparts. The Russians complained. They said, it used to be that if we had an incident occur, we could pick up the phone and immediately get our counterpart in the United States and begin the process of discussion, sharing information, fact-finding, so that the situation didn't blow out of control. But that was taken away. And then, of course, when Joe Biden, once he became president, uttered his now infamous, words to implying that Putin was a soulless killer, the Russians withdrew their ambassador and virtually kicked the American ambassador out of Moscow, leaving us with no diplomatic interaction at a time when things were going crazy. Biden was threatening action against Russia because of cyber attacks. The Russians mobilized 100,000 troops on the Ukrainian border. NATO threatened, that it might have to intervene. We were on the verge of going to war, and a war between the United States and Russia is not a war that could be resolved conventionally. Eventually, nuclear weapons would be used, and when that happens, it's game over for the world. And I don't think your listeners understand how dangerous this situation is. For months, we've been living in a situation where any morning you woke up, the world could come to an end. And I'm not exaggerating. All it would take is one incident to spin out of control, and we had no diplomatic breaks in place to bring this to a halt before things progressed too far. The most important things that happened in Geneva were that Biden and Putin breathe life back into the notion that nuclear war cannot be won. And as long as both sides understand that you cannot win a nuclear war, that means they're not going to be likely to engage in a nuclear war. Under Donald Trump, we had defense officials who believed that the United States could fight and win a nuclear war. Well, now we have a president who says, no, that's not going to happen, and his Russian counterpart agrees. So they have agreed to re-engage on the full spectrum of disarmament and risk reduction. That is, to bring diplomacy back on the table. And then the second thing they said is, we're going to put the ambassadors back to work. We're going to send the American ambassador back to Moscow, and Russia's going to send the Russian ambassador back to Washington, D.C. But it's not just the ambassadors. They said that the Department of State for the United States and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs for Russia will be fully engaged on the full spectrum of issues, working out solutions, discussing the problems. Diplomacy's back. And, now we have a situation where we have old men and old women talking. That's great. It may be frustrating, but it's great, because as long as old people are talking, young people aren't shooting and young people aren't dying. And so this is why I think what occurred in Geneva is so important, fundamentally important. A lot of people say, well, nothing real happened. Something very real happened. Diplomacy was put back in motion. Diplomacy became, a tool that both nations are relying on now, not to become friends, but to control confrontation, to bring predictability and stability to a relationship that was spinning out of control.
What's your take on Putin? Is he as ruthless as the Western press makes him out to be?
Look, Vladimir Putin is, first of all, one of the smartest men in the world today. Anybody who's watched a Putin press conference, and most Americans got a taste of it when he stood up there before the cameras after Geneva and took questions from everybody, including 7 questions from American and British journalists who were very anti-Putin, anti-Russia. I mean, they asked him uncomfortable questions. You know who didn't take a question from a foreign, from a Russian journalist? Joe Biden. His press conference was very controlled. You know, it was an exercise in journalistic babysitting. No tough questions permitted. Only questions from American journalists who were pre-selected. Vladimir Putin stood there and said, "Bring it on, bring it on," and he answered every question. You may not agree with his answers, but the answers were there. They were articulate. They were informed. They were filled with fact. And he's done this over and over and over again, throughout the years. So you got to understand that this is a very smart man who's very well informed, very articulate, very sharp. He's also somebody who has an appreciation for U.S.-Russian relations that most Americans don't. You know, we look at him today through the prism of a U.S. media that is geared towards denigrating him, demonizing him.
Mm-hmm.
But what you have to understand is Vladimir Putin came into prominence in the late 1990s when, mm-hmm. you know, then President Boris Yeltsin picked him out of relative obscurity from a post in supporting the mayor of Leningrad and elevated him to the head of the Russian security services, and then made him prime minister, and then made him president designate. Now, the important thing to understand about this is that during this time of Putin's political elevation, the president of Russia was Boris Yeltsin. Boris Yeltsin was an American tool. We brought him into power back in the 1990s. We sustained him. We stole an election in 1996. You know, for all this talk about Russian interference in American elections, people don't know that the United States stole an election in 1996 to keep Boris Yeltsin in power. And Putin knows this. Putin was listening in on the telephone calls. The National Security Archives have released the transcripts of phone calls between Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin. And if you read the transcripts, especially the latter ones in 1997, 1998, 1999, they're pathetic. Boris Yeltsin is begging for help, begging. And Bill Clinton is the overlord, denying him help, putting him down, this, that. And if you look at who's listening in on the conversations, Vladimir Putin. He's watching, listening as his president is debased, is humiliated by the Americans. So when Putin came into the presidency, you know, most Americans thought he would just be a temporary placeholder, and the Americans were actually actively posturing to get somebody else like Boris Yeltsin to replace Putin. Putin didn't play that game. And that's why there's anti-Putin sentiment, because Putin has taken Russia down a path that deviates from the defeated nation that the United States wanted to sustain once the Cold War collapsed. Putin has said, no, we're not playing that game. Russia is a great power, and Russia will take its proper place amongst the other powers of the world, not as the number one, but as one of many, a multipolar world where Russia has a seat at the table. The United States doesn't want Russia to have a seat at the table. That's not the Russia the United States wants. The Putin Russia threatens American hegemony in Europe and around the world. And this is why people oppose Putin. He's not evil. He's not a killer. He may be ruthless because he inherited a broken, corrupt nation ruled by oligarchs, corrupt businessmen who had acquired billions of dollars under the rule of Boris Yeltsin, the corrupt rule of Boris Yeltsin, who were facilitating literally the rape of Russia by Western economic interests. And Putin has been cleaning house, and he does so carefully. He doesn't do so in Stalinistic fashion, kicking down doors, arresting people, filling up the gulags. He does it by a slow process of managing the legal framework within Russia to delegitimize the oligarchs and re-empower the proper government structures with him at the top. Is it pure democracy, Jeffersonian democracy? Absolutely not. But it's not dictatorship. It's not an autocracy. It's a unique blending of the two, reflective of the harsh realities of the time. And that's Vladimir Putin, and that's the Russia he leads. That's the reality that exists, but you won't be reading about that or hearing about that in American mainstream media. We're incapable of getting down into the dirt and dealing with the truth. We instead have to create these fictions, these narratives that have Putin as being evil and us being good. It's not that simple. It's far more complicated.
You know, the Western press portrays Putin as a ruthless oligarch who amasses fortune, steals art and jewels and money. Is that false?
It's absolutely false. Vladimir Putin is an elected official. He lives a rather modest lifestyle. As president, there are presidential perks. So there are, you know, presidential retreats. There are, our president goes to Camp David. Do we call him a thief of the American people because he dares go to Camp David? And when the president travels, he stays in, our president stays in, hotels and villas in elite places. The Russian president does the same. But in terms of his personal property, it's very modest. And we know this. We know this is the case. People like, Navalny, the opposition figure who's currently in prison for violating the conditions of his parole after he was convicted of, embezzlement and fraud. Navalny released some videos last year that were ostensibly of Putin's palace in the Crimea. It turns out that video was produced by a West German company working with a Los Angeles company with ties to the CIA. The German company had ties to British intelligence. This was all part and parcel of a smear. It's deliberate fabrication, promulgated for the sole purpose of creating dissent in Russia, because Russia is going through some hard times, especially with the U.S.-based economic sanctions. Many of the Russian people are experiencing a reduction in pay, a degradation of lifestyle. And so what the CIA is trying to do is use Navalny to create the impression that while the Russian people suffer, Vladimir Putin and his cronies are living the lifestyle of the rich and famous. It's simply not true. Anybody who knows anything about Russia, anybody who knows anything about Vladimir Putin knows that that's the absolute opposite of who this man is. People who dealt with him when he worked in St. Petersburg, when St. Petersburg was, basically the cradle of corruption. If you were somebody going in trying to get a contract in St. Petersburg, you had to work your way through the St. Petersburg bureaucracy, bribing people before anything could get done. Everybody who met with Vladimir Putin went in expecting that he too would be asking for a bribe, and they were shocked when this man asked questions and then would turn down contracts saying, the time wasn't right or the legal framework didn't exist. He never once, said, bribe me. He never once solicited for a bribe. He never once took a bribe. The man is clean. He is Mr. Clean. But Americans can't accept that about him because we have to demonize him. We have to denigrate him. We can't accept the fact that Russia might actually be ruled by a decent man. Vladimir Putin is a decent man. He's tough. Don't get me wrong. He's not Mr. Warm and Fuzzy when it comes to, people who want to attack Russia, who are operating in ways that are against Russian interests. But to sit here and call him corrupt, to call him evil, to denigrate his appreciation of democratic society, it's just wrong.
What was it about Putin that Yeltsin decided to elevate him?
Well, I think the big thing is that Putin was clean. Putin didn't have any hidden special interests. Everybody else around Yeltsin was basically, maneuvering for favors, for position. Putin was just, I'm going to do the job. And, you know, you've got to remember at the time that Boris Yeltsin was so corrupt, so absolutely corrupt in his family that, you know, because, and he knew that he was going to have to give up power because his health was failing. The thing that Boris Yeltsin feared the most was that once he gave up power, all the sharks that were circling him would come in and would sacrifice him to create cover for the corruption that they wanted to continue. The only person that Yeltsin could trust to protect him was Vladimir Putin, and they cut a deal. And the deal was Putin would be president-designate, but Putin would guarantee that Boris Yeltsin would not be prosecuted for corruption. He basically gave him a guarantee of immunity. And Yeltsin knew that he could trust Putin. If he tried to cut that deal with anybody else, they would have violated it because nobody else could have withstood the pressure that was put on Putin once Yeltsin stepped aside, pressure to continue the corruption, the oligarchs trying to buy him off. Nobody could have survived that. Only Vladimir Putin could survive it. So Boris Yeltsin picked him because he knew that Putin was above the fray and that Putin would keep his word. And you know what? History proved him right.
Okay, so how would you rate the summit that we had this week? Would you rate it as a success?
It's one of the most successful diplomatic engagements in modern history. As I said, it saved the world from the real potential of nuclear annihilation.
Okay, let me ask you this question then. If this is a success, had Trump been elected to a second term, do you think the summit would have been as successful?
There wouldn't have been a summit. Donald Trump was paralyzed by a U.S. Congress that had tied his hands. And he was also paralyzed by his own incompetence. If you remember, the Helsinki summit that Trump did have with Putin turned out to be an absolute political disaster for Donald Trump. The joint press conference he had with Vladimir Putin was just a bad show all around, not only in terms of the optics, but also in terms of the substance, where, you know, Trump was seen as basically, agreeing with Putin over his own advisors, over his own intelligence service. It doesn't matter what the facts are. It doesn't matter that maybe factually the Russians were right and the American advisors were wrong. As president, you don't say that. You don't get up in front of the microphone and say that to the world. You're supposed to be the leader of your nation. So Trump blew that, and there was no way he was going to have another summit with Putin. He may have wanted it, but, you know, Putin's also very smart. Putin isn't going to be engaged in, you know, a process that is counterproductive, not only for Trump, but for Russia. They don't need a failed summit. They don't need a joke. And Putin has sort of alluded to that recently when he talked about Trump. He doesn't condemn the man or criticize him, but he says, you know, he was colorful. He was this. He was anything but serious, professional, the terms that he used to describe Joe Biden. So, no, I don't think Donald Trump could have pulled off this summit. Had Trump been reelected, I think we would have seen the United States and Russia continue this dangerous slide. It might have been a slower slide because Trump wouldn't have, you know, pulled the gas that Biden pulled by calling Putin a soulless killer. That really was a bridge too far, and that pushed relations to the edge of the abyss. It would have been a much slower slide, but it still would have been a slide in the wrong direction because Trump didn't have the political courage to stand up to Congress and tell them to stick it in their ear and you know, responsibly engage with Russia. Instead, he continued to, you know, have to play, I'm the toughest man that's ever existed on Russia, I've imposed more sanctions, et cetera. That was the direction that he would head. His actions were far different than his rhetoric. His rhetoric was, I want to be friends with Russia, but his actions were just the opposite. He actually did a lot to harm U.S.-Russian relations.
And the press did not do anything to dispel that image, right?
Not at all. No, look, the press was all involved in Russiagate in perpetuating the the notion that Russia won the election for Donald Trump, that Russia, put its thumb on the scale of American democracy, that Donald Trump was, bought out by the Russians, was a tool of the Russians, Vladimir Putin's puppet, things of that nature, which were just not true at all, but the press promulgated that. And remember, if you're going to go with that as your narrative, that means that you are painting Putin as the personification of evil. So not only did the press, denigrate Donald Trump, but in the process, they furthered the demonization of Vladimir Putin in the eyes of the American people, so that when Joe Biden took over the reins, it was very difficult for Biden to have this summit. Joe Biden deserves a little bit of credit here. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Joe Biden, but he deserves some credit. This summit was not an easy thing for him to pull off. It wasn't easy for him because for him to sit down with Vladimir Putin, he has to, come at it from a position of strength. And so this is why it was important for him to go to Cornwall, England for the G7. It was important for him to go to, Brussels, Belgium for NATO to breathe life into the notion that America is back, that America is the leader, that America has the world behind it. And he was able to shape this perception, not necessarily the reality, but the perception, so that when he sat down with Putin, he was seen as a strong leader. And then the important thing is he didn't try to solve all the problems. He just initiated a process of diplomacy and diplomatic interaction. But he's being attacked for that even now. People are saying, all he did is empower Putin, like Putin needed to be empowered. All he did was give legitimacy to Putin. And, by not coming out with anything substantive, he ended up looking weak. I think it's just the exact opposite. As Putin has said in talks afterwards, Biden was professional. Biden was sharp. Biden was well-informed.
Right.
Anything but the doddering old fool that, many in the American media and in the Russian press were making him out to be. Putin has gone out of his way to dispel that notion.
Because even Putin says that Biden didn't miss a thing, right?
Didn't miss a thing. He said, he made the same point that Biden made. Biden was like, hey, guys, we talked for nearly 2 hours. World leaders don't do that. We sat down across from each other, and we had 2 hours of straight, hard-nosed conversation. Not demands, not hyperbole, not thumping the chest, not threats. Conversation, exchanges. And, that's impressive. And then Putin basically said, yeah, this dude was well prepared. He didn't get tired. He was on his game the whole time. He knew what he wanted to say. He said it. He listened to what I have to say. He did well. It doesn't mean they agree, but Putin came away. This guy was a worthy adversary. Guy had his act together.
So Scott, we're out of time. I always enjoy talking with you, and as things happen on the international and national front, I will be calling you for your analysis. So you have been listening to Scott Ritter. I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is All Exits Closed. If you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Scott, have a great weekend, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye.
Thanks.